Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer, Mike Malott, and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, John Roerink's got the interview with Dan Kildee, congressman from the 5th Congressional District from Mackinac Island. But let's talk about a couple other things first that happened in the island. Jack, Mike Shirkey said he wants to do something with term limits. The Senate Majority Leader seems to be picking up the mantle from majority leaders before him, Arlen Meekhoff and Randy Richardville is what I'm thinking of, who wanted to do something with term limits. Didn't happen. Mike Bishop, before them, wanted to do something with part-time legislature. That didn't happen. Why doesn't it ever happen?
Well, this is always something that I think is interesting that comes up so frequently. And it's as if they think they can come up with something new or do something themselves, when the bottom line is, in my opinion, there is a national group called U.S. Term Limits that they almost seem to always forget will come zipping in with a whole lot of money and clobber anything they try to do. And one of the first things they do to clobber what they try to do is say that the lawmakers are just doing it for themselves. So if you want to have any chance at all of doing it, in my opinion, you better have 148 people willing to fall on the sword and say, okay, this is going to kick in after we're gone. And the minute you then talk about that, at least half of them lose interest in doing it.
So term limits, Mike, from what you've been able to tell here, have been repealed in some states, but it hasn't been the voters who have done it.
Correct. The 6 states have repealed term limits, and in 2, Idaho and Utah, the legislature did it because they were enacted by statute, and the legislature could do that. 4 states that have gotten rid of term limits by Supreme Court action include Massachusetts, Oregon, Washington, and Wyoming. And the main concern, according to this information that I'm looking at from the NCSL, the main beef that the courts had with the term limits was the way that it was enacted was by statute, and the courts believe that unless it's in the constitutional, you can't do it by statute. It's not constitutional to do it in that way. That's how they got rid of it.
But here in Michigan, it is written into our Constitution, so a court would have to overturn it, and it would have to be at the federal level, and it would have to be some brand new argument that was brought forward, like it was depriving a voter right or something of that nature, a voter's right to choose the person that he or she wants representing them in Lansing, for example.
And from this information, it appears that no challenge in that fashion has been successful yet.
Okay. Jacob, it seems like this would be a very hard thing to get past voters. As Jack mentioned, there would be very strong opposition to it and natural skepticism among voters. It seems like you would need to add something to this, and it would have to be citizen-driven. It couldn't be driven by the legislature.
Yeah. I think with, you know, the legislature, including Republicans, advancing FOIA, you know, opening up the legislature to FOIA, and now recent talk about personal financial disclosure. I think if you wrapped, you know, a series of quote unquote, you know, good government reforms into kind of an all encompassing thing, and then include, you know, lengthening term limits or repealing term limits or however you want to do it into some kind of thing like that, with the idea of this is going to make your government work better for you, kind of thing.
And then it would have to be some kind of group that maybe is established, or it would have to be citizen-led. Like, how about voters, not politicians? Is this something that they could pick up? They've got a strong network. They've been able to put something on the ballot successfully and get it passed, Jack. Maybe that's something they could pick up.
Depends on what it is. If it's going to be getting rid of them, I think that's, again, you're going to have the national group come in that's going to be very well financed, and they're going to, so it's not going to be something that is going to be, you know, a standalone where you're just trying to do it like you would a normal change.
They'd have to extend the term limits. They couldn't get rid of it.
Yeah, I think an extension or some changes to it tied together with some good government stuff may have a chance. It just has always amazed me how people forget that, no, it's not just within the borders of Michigan. There is a lot of money that will come in against it.
To your point about the like a citizens group, I feel like that well has already been poisoned because Senator Shirky is the first one out here. So if suddenly a citizens group emerges, will people think that they're just doing the bidding of, you know, the lawmakers and other special interests? I mean, I agree. I think maybe a better chance of success if this organically comes up from some kind of grassroots movement. And I don't know if that will be as genuine after what we've heard from Senator Shirky now.
The other problem that we've seen with the polling on this is there's a little area right around Lansing where term limits is, unpopular. But that's the only place in Michigan where it's unpopular. The farther away you get away from Lansing, the more people believe in term limits.
One of the bigger news items, I think, happening today on Monday, John James is going to be speaking to the Eaton County, Clinton County Republican Party at its Lincoln Day dinner. I think Lincoln's birthday was probably 4 months ago, but that's neither here nor there.
He had multiple birthdays. People back then, the mail traveled slow. He got cards in June saying happy birthday, Abe, etc. So
we can go ahead. I mean, the spirit of Abraham Lincoln can go all year round, really. I mean, we don't have to just limit it to mid-February. Shoot, I mean, why not, the first Tuesday in June.
And the problem is that the Republicans can still use Lincoln. I think the Democrats have found out that any person from the past had some flaw and they can't use them anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
So at least one party can at least still use a person.
The significance behind John James speaking at this event, Jack?
I think it shows that he's obviously running for something. The question is what?
He would not be spending his time here in mid-Michigan if he were not thinking about doing something, guys.
Oh, absolutely right. I think the key that he doesn't want to say exactly what it is that he is going to do because he wants the speculation to be out there. It generates more discussion the longer he waits to name what he wants to do.
He wouldn't be running for Congress, though, it would seem, Jacob, because if he were running for Congress in the 11th Congressional District, he would be doing this in Oakland County, but it is not the 11th Congressional District. That would be the 7th Congressional District, and he's not running here.
Yes, that is correct. Although we've reported that he is wanted by multiple folks, time will tell kind of where he ends up. Certainly, making the rounds definitely keeps his name up there.
Is this bigger news than Elizabeth Warren being at Lansing Community College on Tuesday, Jack?
I think for us it is. For those of us who cover state government, it's a bigger story. On a weekly, hey, we're going to cover it, the Elizabeth Warren thing is big. But you got to remember, they're going to be visiting here a lot, I think, over the next several months. So, I mean, different candidates. So as far as what's happening at the state level, I think the James thing is actually has more significance.
One last thing that we're going to touch on here before we get to our interview with the congressman. The gas tax is going to be the next big item on the agenda. And the question will be, if not a 45-cent gas tax increase, then what? A little earlier, the MERS team spitballed what the potentials could be here. And it looks like we've kind of settled around, the 15 to 25 range. I had a bit of an outlier there, but and so did Mike. Mike's got the grand skepticism. You got the big fat goose egg.
Right. I don't think they're going to pass any increase in the gas tax. Speaker Chatfield's been very clear that he doesn't want to see a gas tax increase. I think they're going to look for some other place that they can generate the revenue, but it won't be a gas tax.
The skepticism is like the skepticism I have that moonscape that they're creating there on Butler and Ottawa is ever going to result into anything. Jack, I think, though, that we're kind of in the same, you've got 19 cents, I got 32.
Well, my 19 is off the top of the shoulder, but it's like you can say, hey, it's not even two dime.
Yeah, you can say that.
But I think Mike's also on to something, too. There's a very good chance they won't. But the problem is I think everybody knows it. What are you talking about? What time frame are we talking about? Senate Majority Leader Shirky keeps talking about doing something that is really going to be a major change and is going to be looking farther ahead, multiple years ahead. What number you even go after, I think you can't even tell. Are we talking about something that's supposed to be a whole change that lasts for the next 30 years? Are we talking about something that, as opposed to something that's just to handle the immediate situation? I always wonder, how much can you do in a given year? How much money can you spend in a given year? Just literally, physically, how much are you capable in terms of road work? I think there's a lot of different things that go into this. It's not simple.
Jacob?
One thing I want to point out with some of our guesses, which kind of circle around kind of splitting the baby in half in terms of like putting in around 20 cents or so. I think that comes from a pattern of you start high, you start in two places and you kind of meet in the middle. I think roads is a different issue, particularly if the governor or Republicans, I guess, suggest an alternative and come to an agreement somewhere in the middle. I think you run the risk of not only raising taxes, but not completely fixing the problem. The governor came out with the 45-cent tax and took all the flack for it, but she backed it up by saying that we're going to get to this number that everyone is saying is the number we need. With that in mind, there is a possibility that I think Mike could be the closest because they either do all or nothing, because I don't think you can really defend doing something half that's still a tax increase and not a solution.
I know the Senate Majority Leader does not want to do this with a budget. I don't know how you don't do it with a budget.
Oh, I think they're going to do it I think they're going to do it separately from the budget.
Do you really? How do you do that? How does Whitmer, though, back away from that? She said she's not going to sign a budget.
She's not going to sign a budget that has the accelerated increase in it? She's going to veto that?
No, she will sign something that raises money for the roads. But
therefore, she's done the budget at that point. Is she not going to sign a budget so that the schools and the municipalities and everything know in time, you know, to be able to plan? I think it's very awkward. And you have to remember, as far as what the average person deals with on this, there is no satisfying it, because you could put all the money in the world into it, but the roads are still going to be, a lot of Michigan's roads are still going to be in terrible shape a year from now. It literally takes that long for it to play out. So you don't have that immediate, you know, gratification that you have with other things.
That would be very bold, though, guys, to veto the budget because it didn't have road funding in it. Just take it right back and say, nope, incomplete, guys. Does she win on that? I'm not sure.
I think they're playing chicken right now. You know, the game in two cars drive head on at each other at incredible speeds, and see who blinks first. So that's my take on it. But I think the Republicans are trying to come up with a budget that will have an increase for road funding. Have no idea how much. I mean, but they've been tightening down everywhere. All of the budgets have decreases in them that we've seen moving through appropriation.
Well, we've seen the veto threat be very effective in forcing negotiations. I don't know if you're going to have the same dynamic here, where in the auto no-fault, Republicans send Whitmer a bill that she's forced to veto, and what does that look like for her? Does she take the same flack for vetoing a budget with no road funding? And so, depending on how that will force negotiations, we'll have to see.
It already has road funding, though, with the accelerated. So
it's not that much, though. I see what you're saying, but I mean, it's nowhere close to $2.5 billion. It's just an extra, what is it, $300 million or something like that?
Yeah, but I mean, it also, so you're vetoing something that has more. Now, what I think we've seen with the no fault, as far as them being able to negotiate and being able to provide each other with cover, is, yeah, you could get a negotiation and you could see the Republicans doing something else added to that, mm-hmm, to kind of provide the cover for her to be able to sign it. But as far as an all or nothing Mexican, old Western Mexican standoff type of a situation, I think they're going to both do everything they can to avoid it. Also, remember, in the middle of the summer, the legislature has a perfect out for taking some time off because the Senate chamber is not even going to be available.
Well, we'll see what ends up happening. We're going to move on to the interview now with Dan Kilmer. No reasons, what reasons do you need? Tell me why. I don't like Mondays. Tell me why. I don't like Mondays. Tell me why. I don't like Mondays. I want to shoot.
Been doing a lot on the whole PFAS.
Yeah.
Could you kind of give me an update and our listeners,
sure,
an update about where that stands, what has to be done, where you see it going?
Well, I mean, it's a terrible chemical contaminant. We came across it as a result of a chemical contamination of the water, drinking water in Escoda. So that sort of brought us into this whole thing. It is such a ubiquitous substance. It's virtually everywhere in the environment because the uses by the military were pretty much firefighting foam, but the uses in industry have essentially introduced it almost everywhere. So to attack it, one important step is get a better understanding, get better science. Not so much on how dangerous it is, although that's a part of it, but better science to understand the presence of PFAS in the environment. That will help us scale the response. So Congressman Jack Bergman and I have legislation that should move not long after we get back in session that would task the U.S. Geological Survey with locating all of those private sites. The Defense Department sites, there are about 400, technically 401 sites that we know about. In terms of the commercial uses, it's anybody's guess. Mm-hmm. So we need to get our arms around that. And that then gives us the ability to scale the response to the size of the problem. And then try to locate responsible parties who might be in a position of having to fork out some money to help clean this stuff up.
Okay.
Probably the most significant step of the many steps that have to be addressed, the most significant would be adopting an enforceable MCL, maximum contaminant level for drinking water.
Okay.
Also for groundwater, but drinking water is really a real question, because as it stands right now, there's no federal law that sets an acceptable level for PFAS contaminants in drinking water, and we know it's really dangerous.
What's the process to setting it?
There is a process.
Is it Congress that does it? Typically
done by the EPA. Okay. The EPA has the authority to identify a public health threat and bring forward enforceable regulation. They have set a sort of process in place. I say that somewhat pejoratively. Process that we're not satisfied with to explore the development of a drinking water standard, but they're not moving at all. So Congress will most likely have to act. We have legislation that would require an enforceable drinking water standard to be brought back within 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
To get it right, it takes a while. But, you know, it doesn't start. We don't get there unless we start, and that's what we're trying to get the EPA to do.
Okay. Is there a way that you can take action now to sort of end the military's use of it?
They're
still using it, aren't they?
They are still using it to an extent. And I just met with the Assistant Secretary of DOD that deals with all these environmental issues, and she said they're moving away from using PFAS. I don't know what quite that means.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, when we know it's dangerous, we should limit the use of it. So at the very least, what we're asking the Department of Defense to do is to stop using it for training exercises. To be fair, it's a highly effective way of putting out fire.
Mm-hmm.
It works.
Yeah.
But we need to push science and push manufacturers to develop alternatives that don't have these dangerous chemicals in them. In the meantime, at the very least, limit the use of any PFAS-laden firefighting foam to an actual fire where human life is at risk. If we do that, then it's a little easier to justify, but certainly not in training.
Okay. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is there's always, especially lately after the report came out, the Mueller report, there's always a question about how far do you chase this issue as
right.
a Democratic majority in the House. Where do you fall on that issue? What's your thinking?
I mean, I think we have to follow the questions that we have to the point that we're satisfied that they've been adequately answered. And there's still some unanswered questions. I think Mr. Mueller made an attempt to put an end to that by just saying, look, point to the report. I get that, except we don't have the unredacted report.
So do you think he should still be called testify?
I think he should. Even if it means he has to be subpoenaed, and even if it means that he is somewhat limited in terms of how he will answer, the statements that he makes have to be interpreted in their own context. And right now, President Trump and Attorney General Barr and virtually everybody around the president seem to be willing to bend and twist everything Mr. Mueller says to turn it into full exoneration, no matter what he says. And it's clearly not what he said. I would like to hear him answer a specific question as to whether or not there was evidence that the president may have committed a crime. He presented a report that indicates that, but he hasn't had to answer that question specifically. This mm-hmm. is a big enough question that mm-hmm. the stakes are high enough that I think we have to follow it to the point where we are fully satisfied that we know what happened. And we know it without doubt.
Some in your caucus have already talked about impeachment. Have you weighed in on that? What's your thinking?
So I'm sort of a slightly more nuanced position. I think we have to have impeachment on the table.
Okay.
And the president may act in a manner that takes us there because he will leave us no alternative to exercise the oversight that we have to exercise on the executive branch. But I think we first should exhaust every other tool that we have to get as much information as we can get. Some of my colleagues think the way to do that is through an impeachment inquiry. I think it's hard to unwind that once you start down that path. If there's an impeachment inquiry that is intended to get information that may or may not lead to impeachment, I think the momentum is pretty hard to stop. We have tools that we should use. We have subpoena power. We have the ability to go to court to enforce those subpoenas. And that, I think, will be a moment of truth. If in fact, the president does not comply with a legitimate request that a court determines is within the authority of Congress, now we're in a different ballgame. And now, at that point in time, I would say we would have no choice. But I think when it comes to this question, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Mm-hmm. We just need to know everything we can. And the president, you know, he just can't be allowed to say, you can't know, I'm not answering, I'm not allowing anybody who works for me to testify or answer any questions. We're not going to answer subpoenas. And by the way, as long as you continue to, as he says, investigate me, I think it's our legitimate oversight role, but as long as we continue on that path, he's going to punish the American people by not working with us on infrastructure or some other important question. I have very little respect for the way that this person has occupied this office, but I still have to have respect for the office, and that's a really tough balancing act.
Should possible political peril factor into those decisions?
This is where I think a lot of mistakes are being made by both people on both sides of the aisle and many political observers. Speculating as to what the political consequence of an impeachment action is creates a couple problems. One, I don't think we know what the political implications are. We certainly can't say that because when the Republicans impeached President Clinton, it was bad for the Republicans, that that means that it would necessarily be bad. I think views on this president are so baked in the cake that it's hard to imagine how it would influence that. But I get it that some view that it would be bad for Democrats. Some think that if Democrats don't, that it's bad for us because it shows that we're not willing to put our political interests aside when it comes to enforcing the Constitution. All of that's interesting, except I don't think it should have anything to do with the decision that we make. I use the grandchild analogy. I mean, I have two grandchildren. They're 7 and 4. In 15 years, they're both going to be voting age Americans. And I hope I'm around then. And I want to be able to answer their question. What did you do when President Trump trampled all over the Constitution? I don't want to say, well, because it might be politically bad for the Democrats, I decided that, you know, Article 1 of the Constitution wasn't that important.
Speaking of politics, I know it's awfully early. You probably haven't even thought about who you would support in this gigantic field of presidential candidates. But is there anybody that you're kind of looking at thinking, well, that's interesting? Or what's your assessment of the size of the field? Are there anybody that...
I think the size, in part, is an indication of just how moved people are to defeat this president. You know, and I think a lot of folks feel like they are the one, they're going to be the one that can do it, and they're moved by it. It's a very strong commitment that they're making. I have not weighed in, and I'm probably going to take a good long while, because I think the process itself is the proving ground. You know, someone is going, or several candidates are going to navigate this process and come out stronger. That's a pretty good indication of how well organized they are and how fit they are for the office. So they all have different strengths. And I don't want to handicap it, because when there are 23 people running, you know, if there are two or three that I say they're not going to make it, there'll probably be the two or three that are vying for it at the very end. But any one of them, and I know many of them personally, some of them are really good friends, certainly among that lot, any one of them have, I think, stronger intellectual foundation and certainly a greater respect for their system of democracy than what this president has demonstrated.
Okay.
So I'm for who can beat Donald Trump, as long as it's among the group that's in there now. Some of them, you know, I don't know, but I think some of those are less likely to really make it through.
Okay.
That's a long way of not answering that question.
Well, I preface it by saying it's so early. I'm not expecting an endorsement or anything, but I'm just curious what your takes were.
I mean, part of it is, it's this is the first time because, you know, in the last presidential election, it was a sort of Bernie and Hillary, and that was sort of predictable. This is the first time we've had this wide open thing since I've been so close to the process. And so knowing all a lot of these people really well, the first thing you got to get over is imagining that someone you know is a legitimate candidate for president, because we know them too well, you know?
Yeah.
We know the good, the bad, and the ugly. But the truth is, that's the way it is. You know, we elect imperfect people to all these offices. And so the closer you are to it, the more you see the imperfections and less of the polished, you know, view. But they're all really, I think many of them make great, great choice.
Cool. I can't think of any else. I appreciate your
time.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the crew here, Jack and Mike and Jacob. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.